www.themouthmagazine.com.
Every generation enjoys a great book or two, a great album, single, video game, TV show, t-shirt, film. If that generation is lucky, these things will not just occupy the times, but resonate with them. My guest's first book was published in 1993, and though it was a cautionary tale in some ways, by 1996 it had become the most important film of its decade. Several other books and a new play, resident in Edinburgh throughout August's Fringe Festival, have seen my guest time and again explore questions of sex, violence, drug consumption, masculinity, and ultimately, morality. Before we talk, what better way to begin than by saying, choose life, choose the Mouthcast. That was Lust for Life by Iggy Pop, a great song of course, not chosen here by accident. It's closely associated with the iconic film version of one of my guest's many great books. The film is, of course, Trainspotting, and my guest on this edition is Irvin Welsh. Irvin, welcome to the Mouthcast.
Thank you for having me.
Irvin, we're talking ahead of the Edinburgh Fringe run of the new play Performers, written by yourself and Dean Kavanagh. It deals with masculinity at the point when the sexual revolution was saturating culture, so the late 60s. It's a fictionalised account of two London criminals' involvement with the making of the film Performance. That's Scottish filmmaker Donald Cammell and cinematographer Nicholas Rogues, at times surreal cult classic, notably starring Mick Jagger, which brought together the hedonistic world of rock stardom and London's gangster subculture. It was, of course, a very ambitious film.
Yeah, it was very ambitious in content, but also in form. And Cammell was a kind of very experimental filmmaker, and he brought in a lot of imagery. He brought in a lot of Borges imagery, and he was obsessed with Francis Bacon, and he kind of wanted to compose something that was very provocative, and he got more and more into that side of it, into that arty side of it, if you like. And he staked out a strange territory in British cinema. You know, it obviously wasn't Hollywood. It wasn't kind of classic American independent cinema, but it wasn't kind of standard European art house affectations either. And it utilised all these dynamic currents of the 60s, like the breakdown of social class structures, the breakdown of sexual mores and behaviours as well. So it turned out to be a massively interesting film. And we got involved, Dean Kavanagh and myself, basically because it's like Dean's particularly obsessed with the story behind a film. You know, the idea that when a movie comes in to a place, it changes the behaviour of the people around in the community. And I've noticed this in films that I've worked on myself. Trainspotting 2, we had a load of people following us around and just wanting to catch a glimpse of everybody and to know what was going on. When I shot a movie called Good Arrows in Merthyr Tydfil, we used a lot of the old buildings and the old community halls in Merthyr Tydfil in South Wales. And the community really embrace it. You know, they're really fascinated and interested to see how their place is going to be depicted. And it changes things. You know, it does kind of change things. We did a play about called Babylon Heights about the recruitment of the little people into the Wizard of Oz movie. And we wanted to do one about something similar, about these guys who were quite tasty, kind of worldly, kind of sort of London gangsters, but they were actually stepping out of their comfort zone into a whole different world. And one of them was embracing it very comfortably, and the other one was very threatened by it, you know, as I think happens with people. So it's looking at that sort of behaviour. It's very much taken an emotional cue from the movie. I mean, it's a standalone piece. You don't have to see the movie to understand the play. But it's taken a lot of inspiration, not just in the form of it as well, in the form and in the themes and the subtexts from the movie. So yeah, so it's been a movie that we've both loved for a long time, and we feel that it's kind of never really got the credit or the prominence it's deserved. And hopefully you'll get a resuscitation of interest.
On release, the film was actually disowned by the studio, Warner Brothers. It was refused distribution. It was banned in certain countries. And it was attacked by the media over its gratuitous depiction of sex, violence and drug taking. I first saw it by accident, I think, when I was about 10 years old. I was probably stood halfway down the stairs while my parents were watching it on late night TV. I have a memory of that. It blew my mind what I saw. And I watched it again fairly recently, and it had the same effect. It's an incredibly powerful piece of work.
Yeah, I mean, it's like Mick Jagger. I met Mick Jagger on the set of Vinyl. It was like, you know, and it's one of the things that he's most proud of, you know, whenever he talks about performance. I mean, something like Mick Jagger, who's just done so much, you know, it still looks back in this role in this movie. It's not a huge part of his CV, you know?
Yeah.
But he
yeah.
still looks back at it with such pride. You know that this is something really special. This is a kind of a gem that should be unearthed, basically. And James Fox, he's a great character actor. He normally plays upper class tough, but it's right out of his comfort zone on this one and does a brilliant performance, you know? So it's like, you know, you're seeing really top artists doing something different in a way that you wouldn't really see, exposing themselves and taking risks. And the rumor has it that it almost brought James Fox to his knees. He has some kind of a breakdown because it was such an intense experience for him. So it's a film where everybody just went out their way to take as many risks as possible, and that's what makes it so rewarding. And we've tried to capture that kind of spirit of it in the play.
Yeah. As we say, it deals with masculinity at some level. A lot of men find themselves, I think, torn between embracing liberation and clinging to a simpler, perhaps more morally binary past. The theme of sexuality has reared its head in your work before. I'm thinking, of course, of Filth. Again, there's also a film version with a beautiful performance from James McAvoy, which turns out in its last few minutes to be an extremely moving piece of work. John S. Baird was a guest on this podcast around the time of the release of Filth, and I remember him saying that nobody examined issues quite like you. You turn over the stone, if you like, and rather than just look at what's there, you're not content unless you prod it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that masculinity is a kind of, I don't think it's in crisis. I think it's like everything else. Gender is now being seen as a more fluid construct, but you're having the end of capitalism, and you're having the breaking down of the standard division of labour roles. And so you're seeing a much more fluid approach to sexuality and a much more fluid approach to gender. So, and I think, you know, it's one of these things that old dinosaurs like myself feel very threatened by it, but also very liberated by it. In another sense, as an artist, I think it's fascinating to get all these kind of intergenerational conflicts and how kind of people should be perceived and how sexuality and gender should be perceived. And I think in the 60s, in a way, was the kind of harbinger of that, because that's when things really started to break down. You know, you had the pill, for example, and you had the women's liberation movement came out of the pill, basically. You know, it kind of liberated women sexually. And because women were liberated sexually, a lot of men became liberated sexually. Because we are women, and under capitalism, women have always been set up as the kind of gatekeepers of sexuality. That's why all repressive and reactionary regimes try to control female sexuality. Because if you control female sexuality, you basically control the population, you control the whole world. And kind of mullahs, whether they're wearing sort of kaftans or whether they're wearing suits and cufflinks and all that, they understand that implicitly. I think that the real engine to all this change is it's a decline of capitalism, but it's also the growth of feminism. It's also the growth of genuine multicultural, multi-ethnic society.
Yeah, I think at some level your work often deals with traditional masculinity being something of a shot bolt, if you like, in the late 20th, early 21st century. I mean, we're speaking, a couple of days after the announcement by the BBC that the next Doctor Who is going to be a woman, actress Jodie Whittaker. And you tweeted quite beautifully about it, and I quote, "Jodie Whittaker will be a great Doctor Who. All the sexist assholes moaning about it can go wank off over a picture of Tom Baker." Now, I am a particular fan of Tom Baker as a man and as an actor.
Great actor, and excellent human being by all accounts. I've never met him, but what you can do with a tweet like that, you can play around and you can embarrass people that are sexist about this kind of thing. You know, why are you more interested in watching a man on TV than a woman? You know?
Yeah. Absolutely.
You know, so it's like kind of inverts that whole set of assumptions, basically. So I think we should all have a bit of fun and kind of play around with all this stuff now, because that's what it's there for. You know, it's like, you know, life and work and art primarily should be about play. You know, we should have a strong play ethic and a strong mischief ethic about everything we do.
Yeah, and I think quite possibly it is, I mean, it's progressive, but it perhaps also is mischievous by the Doctor Who team to cast a female in the role.
I think nowadays you've got to mix it up. I mean, we have another show in the festival called Creatives, which deals with all these issues of cultural appropriation, and it's set in the music industry, and it's a very modern kind of cutting edge. And we've got elements of a musical in it. We've got elements of a serious social drama. Again, we're trying to mix it up and not be led by quorum or genre. You know, allow the content to determine what kind of form or genre it is, you know, and try and create your own forms and your own genres. I mean, that to me, that's the fun of it all, you know, to try and escape these little straitjackets that the consumer world keeps attempting to box us into. And I think that it's become increasingly sophisticated in doing that with the use of algorithms. And we have to keep moving. We have to keep ducking and diving and dodging these bullets that late capitalism is firing out at us in order to keep doing stuff that's interesting.
Just a perfect day. Drink sangria in the park. And then later, when it gets dark, we go home. Just a perfect day. Feed animals in the zoo. Then later, a movie too, and then home. Oh, it's such a perfect day. I'm glad I spent it with you. Oh, such a perfect day. You just keep me hanging on. You just keep. Just a perfect day. Problems all left alone. Weekenders on our own. It's such fun. Just a perfect day. You made me forget myself. I thought I was someone else. someone good. Oh, it's such a perfect day. I'm glad I spent it with you. Oh, such a perfect day. You just keep me hanging on. You just keep me hanging on. You're going to read just one. Just watch your soul. You're going to reap just watch your soul. You're going to reap just watch your soul.
Again, regarding masculinity in your work, I'm thinking with reference to Begbie in Trainspotting. In their own ways, I think all of the characters in that film are dealing with stepping up to the plate as a man, as it were. But Begbie in particular seems unable to do that because he's trapped inside the walls of his conditioning, if you like. So it was very interesting to see Trainspotting 2 recently and still feel that everyone else had, to one degree or another, moved on, but Begbie was still, I don't know, trapped in 1982 or something.
Yeah, the rest of them are busking it, basically. They're going through that world of uncertainty and they're trying to find a place in it. They're trying to move with the times. Not always succeeding, but they're trying to roll with it a bit. But as Begbie kind of falls back in his old certainties, and there's that very poignant scene where he's with his son at the end and saying goodbye, that eventually it's these certainties that crush him and break him, basically, because they're not really sustainable in the modern world. So he becomes quite a tragic figure, I think, in the film.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a certain moral fluidity, let's say, to Renton and in the end to Spud, but Begbie, at least, I think, and it's admirable in one way or from one perspective. I mean, undoubtedly, he's somewhere on the psychopathic scale, but he at least remains true to his values, true to himself. Is there a virtue in that, do you think? Shouldn't we all be affected by what happens not just to us, but around us?
Yeah, definitely. It's that kind of thing, you know, you want to... You know, you want to be true to yourself and you want to be true to where you come from and how you were brought up and all that sort of stuff. But you also want not to stop growing as a person. You also want to keep engaged with the world as it is. And that's the interesting part of life, to be engaged with the world as it is. Even if you feel you get to a certain point when you feel that world is running away from you and it's easier to move back into your slow disintegrating cliques, I think it's important not to do that. You know, it's important to resist that temptation. And I know myself that it's like I get very, very energized when I hang out with youthful people, you know, like younger relatives, but also sort of, some younger artists are doing stuff that fascinates me, basically. And they have a whole very, very different worldview and a fantastic kind of worldview in a lot of ways. And it's interesting, you know, with the whole, first with the Scottish independence thing and now with the Corbyn rise, you're seeing a whole generation of people that weren't engaged in the mainstream process, that didn't have that confidence, now developing that confidence and having that voice. And I think that's the thing that we have to all be listening to and taking note of. We don't really want to be listening to people that are writing in the newspapers and the Sun and the Daily Mail and the Telegraph, just coming up with the same bullshit that we've heard decade after decade after decade after decade when things start to fall apart at the seams. You've got to listen to the new and the contemporary voices.
Obviously, that's important to you, and your great talent has reaped reward, which means your circumstance is elevated. I wondered how difficult that was for you as a writer, because a writer perhaps needs to remain anonymous in many ways for the cover not to be blown, if you like. But yeah, essentially, at a personal level, are you still fighting the same battles with yourself, if you like?
Yeah,
that you
I mean,
were?
not so much now. I mean, one of the reasons I've not lived in the UK for several years is because of that. I mean, it's like, I mean, living in America has been good for me in that way, that I can just jump on a train or jump on a plane and go to some small town and just hang out in coffee shops and bars and chat to people and all that and get a sense of what's going on, without being like the train spotting guy is doing it, is researching another book or something like that, or just, you know. So it gives me a lot of space to get back to my work, really, and not, you know, to get back to being a writer and not deal with being an author,
yeah,
which is
yeah.
something that is a, you know, is a whole different set of relationships, and it's quite time consuming, which has to be done. You know, you have to let people know you've got stuff out there if they're going to take an interest in it. But you really want to be able to get back to the essence of what it is you do, and that is being a writer, and that is kind of like a disturber of the peace in a way, you know, just getting involved in different things and causing as much trouble as you can, really.
It's that turning the stone over and prodding it thing again that we just talked about, isn't it? But looking back to when your first book was published, I remember thinking, I'd not read anything quite as angry, actually, for a long time. And it was so energising because of that force at the centre of the narrative. You must have been surprised by its success. I think I'm quoting you back at you when I say that you once expressed that middle-class people don't have a clue about the depth and ubiquity of working-class anger. And this perhaps refers to something else that you just said about a generational shift. Because I look at the recent...
I think there is a lot of anger amongst working people, because, you know, you've had the same nonsense right through. You know, you had the Great War, and you had the Homes Fit for Heroes kind of Lloyd George speech after the war. And if you look at all, but since you've had an industrial working class, you've basically had one set of portrayals after the other that has suffered at the hands of the establishment and the system in general. So I think that imbues a whole kind of cultural anger in people. And I think that, you know, in some ways that's been exploited by the establishment and the powers that be. They've deflected that onto other people in the forms of racism, in the forms of the hatred of immigrants, hatred of the other. But I think that eventually, I think this becomes a lot harder to sustain when the people that have the power, the levers of power, can't pay any wages anymore. And this is what's happening. We're heading towards a system of production where we're making not physical goods, but mental goods, like conceptual goods. And we can't pay wages, or they can't pay wages anymore. And nobody's going to listen to their bullshit when they can't pay wages. I mean, the only reason that people listen to rich and powerful people is because there might be something in it for them, i.e. a wage or a bit of patronage or something. But they can't provide that anymore. Everything, the whole spiel that they come out with, just loses relevance completely, because it bears no social reality to how people experience their lives. So it is a kind of, in some ways, there's a whole crisis of conservatism now.
I think, if nothing else, the recent British general election result is great satisfaction to be taken by or from the fact that Westminster and the media were blindsided by the tide of support for Jeremy Corbyn and his manifesto.
Yeah.
Do you agree with that?
There's bigger issues. I mean, I think the ironic thing now is, it's like, until we work out how we're going to replace capitalism, it seems to be the left that are interested in prolonging it. They're interested in kind of eking it out a bit, and, you know, and eking it out more equitably. And it's like, it's actually the right who, through neoliberalism and the greed of neoliberalism, and now through a kind of rats kind of fascism, are the ones that are looking at how you actually crush capitalism and grind it into the dust. It's people on the social democratic left that are saying that, you know, yeah, it'd be nice to evolve into this world whereby we're all writing poetry and making love and painting and gambling around in fields and stuff like that and making up lovely things to look at. But to get there is going to be a very, very difficult journey. And we need to preserve some kind of civic society while we're on that journey, you know. So it's very interesting the way that politics are developing. But I think that the old left and right kind of thing is going to go, and it's going to be about people who believe in freedom versus people who believe in some kind of authoritarian centralist rule. That's the way that the world is going to polarize.
They say, don't they, may you live in interesting times. Irvin, because our time is about up, obviously there's a lot of iconic music in the films that have been made of your books, and quite a bit of it has become iconic because of its association with your work. But for you, is there one particular piece that that sticks out, perhaps something that you hear in your head playing when you're looking back over your memories of the movies?
Oh, I mean, you know, you've got the usual suspects, like Born Slippy is obviously the iconic one that everybody thinks about in terms of Trainspotting, along with Lust for Life. But I think that the great things are the unexpected ones at work. So I would say, in terms of Filth, David Soul's Silver Lady.
Great choice. Irvin Welsh, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks a lot, mate. Pleasure. Cheers.
Shifting from town to town. Every time I'd slip and slide a little further down. I can't blame you if you won't take me back after everything I put you through. But honey, www.themouthmagazine.com.